Looking for a new ride? Shop for your next car from the comfort of your home, 100% online with Carvana. Carvana has a massive inventory, including thousands of cars under $20,000. So finding a car that fits your budget and lifestyle is hassle-free. Carvana makes car financing hassle-free. Get pre-qualified in minutes by answering a few quick questions. Carvana also offers customizable terms and payments as low as $0 down, because payment plans should fit your plans. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to find your next car without ever leaving the comfort of home or anywhere else. Terms and conditions may apply.
Hey everyone, it's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for the New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent, I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what the New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice from the New York Times opinion section. I'm Katie Kingsbury, and I oversee the editorial board. Last episode, you heard the board question South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg on his time as a management consultant. In this episode, you'll hear what we had to say after the mayor's visit. If you haven't heard the interview, go back and listen to that first. Joining me today to talk about the mayor's visit and proposed changes to the Supreme Court is our justice and legal affairs writer, Jesse Wegman.
I'm Jesse Wegman, and I write about the Supreme Court and voting rights and legal issues and democracy reform generally.
Before we turn to the bench, let's listen to what the board had to say about Mayor Pete's visit.
He struck me as like the kind, he is a McKinsey guy. Like, that's the sort of briefing you would get from a McKinsey guy who's looked at the spreadsheets, but it's also the same kind of briefing that you would get from a junior intelligence officer who's looking at the war in Afghanistan and giving you all the metrics to convince you that the winning is possible. And that's what kind of scared me a little bit about that, is because I've seen intelligence guys like that give a briefing and say, you know, Helmand Province is under control because of XYZ, XYZ.
Yeah,
I've seen
totally
the data and I've seen the spreadsheets.
What's fascinating to me about his McKinsey experience is, like, they gave him a 3-year tour of all the things that are going wrong. Like, they took him to the monopoly. They took him to the cost-cutting health insurer. They took him to Afghanistan. Like,
yeah, here's what 40 years of Reagan did.
Like, all this is it. Right. Yeah, he got his tour of neoliberalism. He really did. And he comes out of it and he sort of says, like, I think neoliberalism needs to change. And I believe that he understands the problem, but I'm not sure he gets it. And a politician, success as a politician requires you to cathect. It requires you to convince voters that you feel their problems. And I do not get the sense, maybe it's because I'm not from the Midwest, but he did not give me the sense that he feels these problems.
This board holds pretty much all the same positions he does. I mean, almost to a platform. So it's kind of funny that there's this idea that isn't bold enough, because then as a board, we aren't bold enough.
The fight language is about, and the Mayo Pete thing and the social media thing is about, like, a real generational anger and response to very large forces, to a financial crisis, to student debt, to climate change, to all these things that are very, very real. And though they may represent themselves on the internet in an annoying way to somebody like that, I just think this idea that, like, it's not quite a civility message, but I think he has, like, this worldview of good faith from institutions that Americans see as almost primarily responding in bad faith all the time.
And that, I think, ties into Aisha's question at the beginning about old normal and new normal. And here he is trying to distinguish himself from the old normal, but what he's talking about really is a return to something that just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. I mean, even his tone, when he said that the difference really is tone, I think that's not what people want right now. And not even just young people, like people who have been disenfranchised for the longest time. And I think, to me, that's kind of like walking into this, my opinion of him was like, meh. And it's still kind of meh. Like, I don't feel excited by him.
So, Jesse, what was your impression of Mayor Pete?
You know, he came as advertised. I thought that he's been identified by many people as a kind of a Obama for 2020. And a lot of Obama's former staffers have either climbed on board or have come out in support of him. And he certainly has the former president's political instincts in some regards. And in others, he just seemed to be lacking. He doesn't have that energy around him that Obama did, or even that someone like Beto O'Rourke had for a little while. And I was struggling to figure out what the disconnect was there, because he's clearly a bright and thoughtful person. His political experience is wanting, but so is Barack Obama's at this point.
Do you think that could have anything to do just with the fact he's from the Midwest and his affect is very Midwestern?
I just don't think that that's a significant element in this. I mean, that, you know, Barack Obama was from Illinois, Bill Clinton was from Arkansas. I think the issues run deeper than being Midwestern. I think it comes from something about his temperament.
Does his relative youth give you pause?
It gives me some pause, but no more than and possibly even less than the older candidate's age does. So I think this is an interesting situation. We could have the oldest president in history or the youngest president in history from the same group of candidates. And there are pros and cons to both, but that's not the most concerning thing for me about him.
More from our deliberations after a quick break.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/NYT. netsuite.com/NYT.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice.
Senator Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg don't come off to me as less passionate.
Yeah, I agree.
They just come off to me as more Midwestern. And maybe that's just a disconnect, but...
There is a Midwestern mode of expression. It is sort of modest in its presentations, and it's even.
But like 99% of the population fits on the emotional register between Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg. And like...
He told us a bit about his pitch to add more justices to the Supreme Court. Can you walk us through his plan a little bit?
Sure. So the Supreme Court has been a very powerful motivator for voters on the right for years now, you know, mostly around issues like Roe v. Wade, but on a lot of hot button cultural issues as well. And it just hasn't broken through in the same way for Democratic and more liberal voters. And I find that astonishing, especially after what we saw happen in 2016 with, you know, Mitch McConnell blocking even a hearing for Merrick Garland, Barack Obama's pick. You know, so now I think we are seeing more Democratic interest in the court and a more of an understanding. But it's still, I'm not sure that's going to be enough to drive people to the polls the way it did for conservatives in 2016. You know, I'm convinced that it's the makeup of the Supreme Court that what matters. And that's why I wanted to press all of the candidates on this question that we asked of whom they would nominate if they were elected. And I thought Pete Buttigieg, of all the candidates, had the most well-developed ideas about how to address that reality. And I liked his idea of expanding the size of the court. The idea in short is... The court would go from 9 members up to 15. 5 of those members would be appointed by Democratic presidents, 5 by Republican presidents, and the last 5 would be unanimous picks of those first 10, and they would serve 1-year terms. I'm sure the details of this could be hashed out. I'm sure there would be legal challenges to it, constitutional challenges to it, but I liked the way that Mayor Pete was coming at a sort of a really big structural institutional problem where we're facing a dysfunctional court and a court that I think in many people's eyes has become hopelessly politicized and trying to find a way out of it.
Has the court changed sizes before?
It has. I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that prescribes the number of justices that have to sit on the court. It's been as high as 10. It's been as low as 5, 6, 7. It hasn't changed from 9 since the middle of the 19th century. But as I think Pete rightly pointed out, and as he said on the campaign trail, conservatives who carp about this idea of what they call court packing themselves, you know, they changed the size of the court just 4 years ago to 8 members in order to hold it until they could establish a hard right majority on it. So I don't think they have any standing to complain about bigger picture ideas of changing the number of justices. I'm also not convinced that 9 is some sacred number that we need to stick to. You know, this is a moment in our history that calls for major rethinking of a lot of accepted elements of our democracy, and I think this is one of them.
When FDR pushed the idea of expanding the court back in the 1930s, there was a lot of political pushback. Can you tell us about that?
For starters, I think we should just remember that there's a lot of dispute over whether what happened when FDR proposed his plan to expand the size of the court, or more accurately, to add a certain number of justices for all justices who were older than, I think, 70 at the time. Whether that proposal is what triggered the court's shift into becoming more receptive to New Deal legislation, or whether it was other things happening. So I don't want to get too speculative about what a change in the size of the court might do. I think what we really need to pay attention to, and what I think Pete's plan, which a couple of the other candidates over the last few months have also expressed interest in, would hope to achieve, is depoliticizing the court, right? So we have a court right now where everyone thinks these justices are either Republicans or Democrats. And while I don't think they necessarily map so easily onto those political labels, they certainly have ideologies that very nicely fit with Republican or Democratic administrations. And right now, for I think the first time in decades, we have a court where all of the conservative justices have been appointed by Republicans and all the liberal justices appointed by Democrats. So anything that can be done to change that situation, I think is beneficial. And I think Pete's plan is as good as any that I've heard to try to do that. Also, though, any Democratic president is going to need to bring along the American public, and especially liberals, to understand the importance of a court that isn't hopelessly in the tank for the right wing. So I just think any Democrat who becomes president is going to have to face this reality and is going to have to figure out how they deal with an intransigent right-wing Supreme Court. And if that means convincing a majority of Americans to elect Democratic Senate and to elect Democratic presidents who will then appoint to the court more liberal justices, that's one route. If it's trying to depoliticize the court overall by expanding the number and the nature of the justices, that's another way. But they can't pretend that it's not a central issue to their governance.
He is sort of calibrating everything he says to speak to that sort of more centrist, middle of the road, middle of America voter. And to what degree is he just so emotionally level that he can't actually emote much? Or it's just not his character to do that. And so, like, the words themselves may be sort of appealing to that middle America voter he sees, but can he ever sort of inspire people?
But it's not just a question of affect. There's also the modesty of his ambitions. He has, for example, argued that we should prevent homelessness for families with children, while many of his opponents have gone further and said we should end homelessness. So, you know, he is choosing quite consciously on a whole range of issues to stop well short of where the party's frontier is. And the question is why, basically.
You and I have often talked about in the past your disappointment in the fact that President Obama and other Democrats have not thought about age as they've picked the members of the court that they appoint. Can you tell us why that's so important?
Well, sure. I mean, it's in a lifetime appointment scenario, which is what we have right now. And I just want to be clear, term limits for justices would almost certainly require a constitutional amendment. So that is not a small lift. It's actually would be easier to expand the size of the court than to change that rule. But I mean, when you're putting people on the court right now, you know, President Clinton's appointments to the court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, are older than people who were appointed before him, you know, Clarence Thomas. So it just stands to reason that if you believe in somebody's jurisprudence and you think they are a good justice, you want them to serve on that court for as long as possible and wield their influence on the court for as long as possible. And if justices are only getting, say, 15, 20, 25 years on the court instead of 30 or 35, that can be all the difference. You know, Justice Kennedy spent, I think, 3 decades on the court, and some of the most important and consequential decisions he made were in the last couple of years of his tenure.
So, Jesse, why did you ask each candidate who they wanted to have on their Supreme Court shortlist?
Well, look, it's a sort of a layup in one sense, right? But I also knew that almost nobody was going to answer it. And as it turned out, nobody did. But I wasn't really going for names so much as trying to get a sense of what kind of person the candidates might choose and also how they understood the importance of the court in our larger system of government. I will say, though, I don't get why they wouldn't name names. You know, it's not hard to come up with several dozen really high-quality, smart, young candidates out there who are women, who are people of color, who I think would actually excite liberals to get to the polls in the way that Donald Trump's list excited conservatives back in 2016. I brought this point up to Pete and to all of the other candidates.
Can you give us some names of people you'd consider nominating to the Supreme Court?
So again, I think it's irresponsible for me to name check folks for the future.
Trump did it.
And he is not my role model on things like this.
But it helped him.
I'm sure it did. Lots of things he did helped him that I will not be emulating.
At some point, you got to understand that the Supreme Court matters and that you have to get that idea across to the public in a way that excites them and not just as some abstract concept. You know, Roe v. Wade is on the line here. Are you going to pick somebody who saves it or not?
Okay, that's it for Mayor Pete. Come back tomorrow to hear the board interview former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. Thanks for listening.
The Choice is produced by At Will Media. Mitch Bluestein, Molly Socha, Ashley Taylor, and Rachel Leitner, with help from Michelle Mason. Mixing by Lauren Gardner and original music by Allison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to Tyson Evans from The New York Times. Our executive producers are Will Malnati from At Will Media and Phoebe Lett from The New York Times. Finally, we want to hear from you. Please rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. It'll help more voters find the show.